WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When Syra Shah first went to Afghanistan as a young journalist, she found a country ravaged by years of war, a reality far different from the Afghan myth she grew up with in Britain. In her new memoir, Shah reconciles the myth with reality and Afghanistan's past with its precarious future. Tonight, On Point, journeying into Afghanistan with the storyteller's daughter, journalist and documentarian, Syra Shah. But first, the U.S.-led campaign to cut the financial umbilical cord of terror is being frustrated. Publicly, the Treasury Department says it has made great strides in freezing assets of suspected terrorist funds. Privately, Treasury officials tell a story less encouraging, according to Josh Meyer, who covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him to explain the discrepancy between the public and private accounts of the money front in the war on terror.
A lot of it is in the execution or lack thereof in this. I think a lot of nations, according to senior U.S. officials, are paying a lot of lip service to the financial war on terrorism. The concern is that they're not actually going forth and doing the real hard work, which is freezing assets and going after the money flows.
Where you are right now, Dubai is a kind of paradigm of the problem, isn't it?
According to some officials, yeah. I mean, one guy describes it as a sort of Star Wars bar for terrorists and for financiers of terrorism. It's a very cosmopolitan but almost anonymous place where you can pretty much do whatever you want.
And you mentioned going to a bazaar there where you can you could probably finance some terrorism yourself.
Well, it's called the Souk, and it's basically like an old, sort of an old-fashioned money changers type of bazaar where, yes, you can buy and sell gold and jewels and currencies, and it's sort of a no-questions-asked type atmosphere.
And you paint a picture here of the Treasury Secretary, Mr. Snow, driving through Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and passing by a shopping center that is sort of built by people who have financed al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups.
Well, we have to be careful to say that they've been accused of financing terrorism.
Accused of, beg your pardon.
But it wasn't a shopping center as much as it is a commercial center with a lot of glittering, very expensive buildings. These are guys known as the Jeddah merchants, and there's at least seven of them that have been accused by the United States, the United Nations, and others of being some of the original financiers of al-Qaeda going way back about 10 years and providing the organization and bin Laden, who grew up in Jeddah, with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Now, you speak of internal resistance in these countries to uncovering these networks. Talk about that for us.
When the U.S. government designated some of the Jeddah merchants right after 9/11 as being financiers of terrorism, one of them was a guy named Wael Hamza Jalaiden. And initially, the Treasury Department boasted that the Saudi government was on board and that it was a mutual designation. No sooner had they done that when Saudi Arabia's own, you know, their John Ashcroft, essentially, a guy named Prince Nayef, publicly declared that Jalaiden was innocent, he hadn't done anything wrong, and that the Saudi government wasn't cooperating with that. And the Saudis now insist that he was misspeaking, but he's the head of all counterterrorism efforts in Saudi Arabia. And U.S. officials have long been worried that Nayef and others have been sort of dragging their feet when it comes to going after terrorism. Many other countries are far better than Saudi Arabia when it comes to that, but even countries throughout Europe are balking at what they think are overly aggressive efforts by the United States to go after individuals and companies.
And some of this, of course, just laps over into globalization, doesn't it? Freer financial flows, that sort of thing.
Right. I mean, when we were in Pakistan, I went with the secretary. We went through about five countries on the way here to Dubai to see how the financial war on terrorism is being waged. And one of those was Pakistan. And the finance minister of Pakistan, a guy named Shaukat Aziz, basically at a news conference said, that they're working very hard, the United States is working very hard, but that you need the help of all of the countries involved to stop it. If money is going from point A to point B to point C, you have to have all three players involved, and he said that's not the case right now.
Now, you mentioned human couriers. You also mentioned animal couriers moving large volumes of cash.
Well, I think it's just pack mules and things like that. And when you're talking about some of these countries, it's very backward, very rugged terrain, such as the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. They think that there's pack mules and other animals like that, perhaps even camels, yes, that are currying money. In one instance, according to some of the Treasury officials, they're making huge candles out of wax and wrapping or making the candles around bundles of cash and shipping them that way. The one thing that I would stress, though, is that U.S. officials have been working very hard on this. I wouldn't want to give the impression that they're not. They're working 18-hour days, and they're traveling around the world. The problem is getting everybody else to join in on the battle is the hard part.
And even on this end, these prosecutions of, quote, charities seem to have come in waves. There were some at the initially and then a long period without them, and now we've read about more in Virginia. So, in other words, even
right.
here we're finding out more about them.
Right. I mean, a lot of this war is being waged sort of undercover, like with intelligence and by the CIA and things like that we'll never know about. But the public prosecutions have come in waves. The one successful one that we've had so far was against Benevolence International in Illinois, and the guy who ran that, Enam Arnaud, ended up pleading guilty to not exactly terrorism charges, but something lesser than that in exchange for cooperating in the ongoing investigation. So it's tough to make these cases, especially when a lot of the information you're using can't be used in a criminal case because it was gained by the CIA and other intelligence agencies.
And also, it's hard to make the Hamas-Hezbollah argument to countries and people who see these as, quote, charitable organizations. They don't look at the terrorism side. They just look at the social services side.
In fact, on TV today, I just saw the UN representative from Syria, who is insisting that Hezbollah and Hamas, you know, are political, charitable organizations, and they do provide some functions in that regard, in terms of providing social services and so on. But both of the groups have military wings that have been clearly tied to terrorism, certainly in the United States' opinion.
Are the Europeans also reluctant to cut off flows insofar as they can to Hamas and Hezbollah? Is there a difference in view from Europe and the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think the United States is considered almost one of the only countries that as hardline with regard to both terrorist groups, alleged terrorist groups, than anybody else. After Hamas took credit for a bombing in Jerusalem a few weeks ago that killed 23 people, that turned the tide, and France and a lot of other countries, I think, are now on board. But as top Treasury officials said in testimony before Congress last week, it's really an uphill battle getting people to come on board.
It does seem extraordinary so long after September 11th, with so many terrorist outrages around the world, there should still be this kind of reluctance even among Western countries.
Well, I mean, I know U.S. officials are very frustrated by it. One guy who I've spoken to, actually who was on the trip with Secretary Snow, one of his most senior counterterrorism officials, mm-hmm. described coming to these countries and having these meetings as akin to going to the dentist. It's just not very pleasant because we're trying to get them to do things that they don't want to do in many cases, and it's like pulling teeth.
I can imagine. Josh Meyer, thanks so much for staying up late and talking to us.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Dubai. Cyrus Shaw grew up in Britain with a romantic picture of her ancestral Afghan homeland, created through her father's stories. Years later, as a journalist and documentary producer, she would bear witness to the country's war-torn reality, its years of warlordism, civil war, and finally, oppression under the Taliban. A country now wrestling with a 21st century understanding of gender equity and democracy. In a new memoir, Shah paints an intimate portrait of Afghanistan's wounded recent past. After decades of war and religious dictatorship, is Afghanistan ready to embrace democracy, tolerance, women's rights? Can Afghanistan overcome its past? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Cyrus Shah, journalist, documentarian, and author of the new memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us. I wonder, Cyrus Shah, if you could begin with the first two paragraphs of your memoir. Read for us.
I'd love to.
Thank you. I'll read.
I am 3 years old. I'm sitting on my father's knee. He is telling me of a magical place, the fairy tale landscape you enter in dreams. Fountains fling diamond droplets into mosaic pools. Colored birds sing in the fruit-laden orchards. The pomegranates burst, and their insides are rubies. Fruit is so abundant that even the goats are fed on melons. The water has magical properties. You can fill to bursting with fragrant rice, then step to the brook and drink, and you'll be ready to eat another meal. On three sides of the plateau, majestic mountains tower, capped with snow. The fourth side overlooks a sunny valley where, gleaming far below, sprawls a city of villas and minarets. And here is the best part of the story. It is true.
That's the story your father told you about the Afghanistan he remembered. And, of course, in your film, if I recall it correctly, Behind the Veil, you go there and the place is a waste today.
Yes, beneath the veil. That's absolutely true. I did get finally to Pohman for the first time in my life during the filming of Beneath the Veil. And it was a shock. The ground was seeded with mines. The fruit trees had been cut down for firewood. The fountains and watercourses were all smashed and destroyed. It was really a metaphor for the destruction of Afghanistan over the past years. I did find a little bit of blue mosaic from one of the watercourses, and it made me think that the fact that I had heard the story when I was a child had enabled me to see that it must have been very beautiful once.
How did your father come to be parted from this earthly paradise?
Well, our family was really very peripatetic, and I think that it was a long process and sort of hidden in family myth. He was always very unspecific about it. But I come from a mixed, I'm the product of a mixed marriage. My mother was a Parsi from India, or is a Parsi from India. My father was Afghan. And I grew up and was born in Britain, yet a third country. And I think my father felt that it was very important that I and my brothers and sisters know or feel that we have a homeland, that we have a place that we come from. So he used to drum into us, "You're Afghan."
You're Afghan. And, of course, you went back there beginning during the Soviet war, Soviet-Afghan war.
Yes, I'm part Afghan, I think. I think that's one thing that I learnt during my travels. I went out to Afghanistan when I was 21, really looking for this fairy tale, chasing this myth, and wanting to believe that it was true and wanting to believe that I was entirely Afghan. And I think over the course of the next few years and many trips into Afghanistan, I began to realise that, you know, my background is different and a part of me is Afghan, but a part of me maybe belongs to the West. So I'm caught in the middle, really. But I did travel with the Afghan Mujahideen resistance during the time when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan. And America, the United States, was supporting the fighters, the Mujahideen fighters. It was seen very much as the front line in a superpower conflict, a conflict between East and West. What I began to see was that perhaps there was another battle going on, that some of the people there felt they were fighting a different battle, and that was a battle for Islam.
That is to say, radical Islam, a kind of purification, the sort of purification that the Taliban tried to effect when they took power.
Yes, radical Islam. Yes, thank you. That's a good correction, actually, because, you know, certainly it's not the Islam that I was brought up with. Not quite the Taliban's Islam, but what would come to be the Taliban's Islam. There were a lot of people from outside other parts of the Islamic world, particularly Arabs. Many of them were Wahhabis. I passed in the 80s great installations in carved out of the rock. And later, you know, there were strange sorts of Mujahideen who were very unfriendly. And the Afghan Mujahideen said, these people just want to be martyrs. So we help them on their way by sending them to the front line so they can get killed. And it was quite alien to Afghan culture at the time. Yet it did take root in Afghanistan at that point.
And that feeling of being at the locus of a superpower conflict, that still, of course, is right there with Afghanistan, isn't it? They're right now, they're the front line in the war on terror. The American war.
Well, exactly. I think history has come not quite full circle, because history never repeats itself exactly, but there are patterns in the cycles of history, if you can just see them. And now, again, we have a situation where Afghanistan is seen as tremendously important. As you say, it's a front line in the war against terror as far as the West is concerned. I wonder and I worry, I think that perhaps just as, we in the 80s we thought it was the superpower conflict, perhaps now something else is going on.
We're talking tonight with journalist and documentary producer Saira Shah about her new memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter. As the new Afghan leadership drafts the country's constitution, what issues should be at the top of the agenda? Women's rights? Religious freedom? Or are these demands a species of Western cultural imperialism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beattie, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with journalist and documentary film producer Syra Shah about her new memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Syra Shah, I wonder if you could read another bit from your memoir. This about your earliest, that is during the Soviet period, your trip to Afghanistan, because it really sets up your second trip as well, and certainly the feeling of being in two worlds. Would you do that for us?
Yes, of course. This is just a little incident just after I'd been shelled, I was about to be shelled for the first time, but it's
shelled by Soviet artillery.
It was Afghan Army Communist artillery.
Okay. Yeah.
And this is just something that happened just before it. When we were almost at the border, we passed a man herding goats, the first flocks we had seen for weeks. With my famished eyes, I no longer saw cute little animals, but food. With sudden inspiration, I asked how much it would cost to buy one. The price was about £40, a considerable sum in Afghanistan, and to me. I bought it immediately. Instantly, our group was on holiday. The Mujahideen took turns to lead it along on a string. Its desperate bleating only added to our festive spirit. We smiled when we caught each other's eyes. Tonight, we would have a feast. With our guard down, we walked straight into the ambush. By now, the path had widened as we crossed a valley. Mortar shells began to fall, both in front and behind us, which I later came to learn is usually bad news. It means you're in the middle of the range. My first feeling was a sort of indignation. I wanted to shout, "I'm nice, you idiots. I'm a nice person. I've never harmed anyone. Why on earth do you want to waste good ammunition on me?" A few weeks ago, I'd been at university, going to student gigs and drinking cappuccino in the Union Cafe.
Now that, a memory from the 1980s, really connected with my memory of your 2000, I guess you were there, 2000 and 2001 film about Afghanistan, and especially the sense of you're coming in from another world. And tell us how you actually got into Afghanistan then and how you had to sort of get in mufti in order to survive there.
That's true. While we were filming Beneath the Veil, at the end of the filming, which was quite protracted, we realized that we hadn't had a chance to speak to Afghan women, particularly living under the Taliban. So we felt that I ought to go undercover. So I literally got undercover. I put on the burqa, the veil, and I had a little pinhole camera in the front of the burqa, and I also had another camera in a bag. And crossed the border into Afghanistan in the company of a very brave group of women called the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. Ironically, I was invisible under the burqa. I could get across the border because I was wearing the burqa, and I didn't even need identification. I traveled in with a man and a woman, and we two women were just written into the man's pass, you know, so-and-so and two women.
And that was the beginning of your trip behind the veil and behind the lines, too, as it were. I remember a striking scene in that film of a sort of clandestine beauty parlor. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. I mean, I'd seen all sorts of things by that time. I'd seen secret schools. I'd seen, you know, we'd filmed in the hospital and seen it had been collapsing because the health workers were not able to go there. We'd seen women, you know, having to eat dried bread and women taking terrible risks for things like education and so on. And then I couldn't believe it, really, when I found this beauty parlor and they were taking the same terrible risks for makeup. And it seemed absurd. And then one of the women turned around and said, "Well, you don't understand. This is about our rights to live our lives the way we want to live them. And, you know, it's about defiance." So I found that very, very interesting.
They were putting on makeup behind the veil, and then they would go out, but they'd have the secret knowledge that they had done this taboo thing, really.
Well, yes, I mean, beauty parlors were banned, and so if they'd been caught, you know, it sounds silly, doesn't it? But they could have gone in and busted the beauty parlor, and they'd all have gone to jail.
Yeah, I mentioned in my lead up to the show that your documentary, Beneath the Veil, showed repeatedly on CNN in the lead up, the weeks leading up to the U.S. attack on the Taliban. And it sort of made the connection for many people. The Taliban are bad. Look at this movie. See what they do to women.
I rather take issue with that. Actually, I'm glad you asked me about that because I did hear it going out. You're absolutely right. It was shown, you know, enormously on CNN. I did a lot of interviews at the time saying exactly what I'll say now, which was, you know, we made it before 9/11. And if we had known, you know, particularly that the Northern Alliance were going to be prominent, we would have, you know, put in health warnings about the Northern Alliance as well. But having said that, I think the message of Beneath the Veil was not go in and bomb. And I kept a very close eye on, certainly on viewers' calls and responses, because I was, you know, I was very worried that, that people would think this. And I found that at least as many people, if not many more people, said to me, or said, before this film went out, we thought that the Taliban and the Afghan people were the same thing. And this film has taught us that there are people in Afghanistan suffering under the Taliban, just as, you know, the West had suddenly suffered from the Taliban. So, of course, there were depressing people who said, nuke them. But I'm afraid I believe that those sorts of people probably would have said, nuke them, whatever they saw. It certainly wasn't the message of the film. And I still don't think that that's the message that it portrayed.
You mentioned that if you knew that September 11th was going to happen, or if you had made the film after that, you would have done some things in the film very differently. What would you have changed?
Yeah, well, as I said a moment ago, and as I said at the time, we definitely would have put in more health warnings about the Northern Alliance.
That is, talking about its human rights record.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When we went to northern Afghanistan, the Northern Alliance looked as though it was completely spent. They were on the brink of complete defeat, of being completely wiped out. And so we spent more time talking about the Taliban. Had we known that the Northern Alliance would come back, we certainly would have spoken about their human rights track record. I also, at the time, deliberately did a lot of interviews in the US about it and brought up this point because it was something that I felt was important to bring up.
That is, to give us a fully rounded sense of what the alternatives were in Afghanistan.
Absolutely, yes. And again, in this book as well, I try, you know, everything you do, every piece of work you do is a product of its time, inevitably. And the book obviously was written after 9/11, and I again tried to put more context in. I also tried with the book to counterbalance a little bit some of the grimness of the reporting, including my own reporting, which really portrayed Afghanistan as a country of horrendous human rights, dreadful instability, collapsed infrastructure, which it is all those things. But on the other hand, there is very much more to Afghanistan, and there is a great deal of positive. I mean, I fell in love with Afghanistan at least twice. I fell in love with it before I'd ever seen it from the stories that my father told me. And when I eventually went to Afghanistan and discovered a slightly different place, I fell in love with that as well. So I tried to put in the book some of the spirit of Afghanistan so that people who wouldn't necessarily read a political book or whatever, they can at least read this and hopefully have a good read, but also understand perhaps something beyond the facts and the statistics. There is it's a very special place. There's a very special atmosphere in Afghanistan.
The generosity of people is what I remember from the film.
Absolutely. I mean, incredible generosity. Again, something I write about in the book is when I went to stay in a safe house in Kabul when I was doing the undercover, and the little family produced this amazing meal, which, you know, people just didn't have that kind of food in Kabul at the time. And we were all sitting in the darkness because there was no electricity, and it took me a few minutes to realize that they were pretending to eat. They were feeding me, and they were pretending to eat. And it broke my heart.
Oh, my gosh.
It broke my heart.
Oh, what a moving scene. It takes us a little afield, but you say a very interesting thing. You talk about the conflict in Islam between, and I'm quoting you now, those who cling to the literal letter of the Islamic law and those who stress its inner values. Tell us about that conflict. Where is it being played out? What's at stake? How is it being fought?
Well, you can see it. You can see it everywhere in the Islamic world, really. I think we're at a period where The movement towards the literal is on the ascendant. People tend to think of Islam, divide up Islam in a different way into Sunnis and mm-hmm. Shias and radical Islamists and so on. And I've kind of, for this book, divided it in a different way. I've looked perhaps at the people who want to see the literal and enforce the literal letter of the law, and people who would prefer to enforce the spirit of the law. My family background is Sufi, who are Islamic mystics, and therefore are very much on the metaphorical rather than the literal side, and are, you know, very much in a minority. But I think that there is also a vast silence. I hope it's still a majority. I don't know the figures of Muslims who are moderate and are not extreme. But the thing is, they by virtue of being moderate, they tend not to stand up and shout and froth at the mouth and say, you know, my version is the only version. I certainly grew up with all sorts of sayings of the Prophet, things like women are the twin halves of men. Mm-hmm. The ink of the scholar is better than the blood of the martyr. A minute's thought is better than the whole night of prayer. And a line from the Quran, let there be no compulsion in religion, which, you know, I've often wanted to say to the Taliban.
These are some of what you call the inner values of Islam.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think Islam has a, you know, an amazing spirit and philosophy. And one of the most powerful things about Islam, I feel, as a religion, is that it doesn't claim to be the only valid religion. It says that Islam is a continuity of Judaism, Christianity, the people of the book, which is an amazingly tolerant outlook. It's just the interpretation of Islam changes among different people.
You mentioned that those who stand for the metaphoric understanding or the inner values, as opposed to following the literal letter of the Islamic law, are the silent majority. Why are they silent? Why is it that, for example, if one of our listeners were to turn on AM talk radio right now, they would probably hear an AM talk radio host drawing a caricature of the entire Islamic world based upon the most fanatic element of it?
Yes, isn't that a terrible thing? I don't think it's that is entirely the fault of the Islamic world. I think it's also perhaps the fault of the people who don't look beyond the headlines or look beyond the most dramatic thing. Again, as I say, by virtue of being moderate, it's the same with any religion or any political movement. It's the fanatics who tend to jump up and down and shout the loudest, and moderates tend to be quiet. But it's also quite dangerous. You know, I feel worried sometimes, you know, saying I'm a Muslim and I'm really very liberal and I, you know, certainly don't veil and I go around. Mm-hmm. And in some countries that will get you in trouble.
Yes, it will. And have you felt any pressure of this kind toward orthodoxy yourself? People saying you're giving, you know, scandal to the goyim or whatever the equivalent is?
Certainly not in America, but there are countries where you definitely do, and Afghanistan is one of them. I mean, that is always a tightrope for me, you know, and I'll dress differently depending where I am. Sometimes I will wear the veil, sometimes I won't, and it's a matter of sort of negotiation, really.
And what are we to understand about the situation of women? I mean, obviously in Afghanistan under the Taliban extreme, but as you know, a report by Arab intellectuals for the UN a year or so ago said that the situation of women in the Arab world, not I don't know about the Islamic world as a whole, but in the Arab world, was one of the main things that was holding that world back socially, but also economically. Why the lag? I mean, you could say the same thing, I'm sure, about Western, you know, talk about the West in any other century but the 20th century. But why this lag, and why the necessity to control women according to the old orthodoxy?
I don't pretend to understand it either. I think it's wrong. I think you're right that what you do when you kind of constrain women is you deprive yourself of 50% of your own talent, your own society. And it's certainly something that I noticed in the Taliban's Kabul, that it was as though, you know, nothing's in a vacuum. You can't just take the women out of the equation. It was as though the women were the foundations of a building. And once you pulled those foundations up, the whole building came down. So Kabul had completely collapsed. Society had completely collapsed. For instance, 70% of women 70% of teachers in Kabul had been women. So it wasn't a matter of depriving just girls of schooling. Mm-hmm. Girls and boys were deprived of schooling. And it's the same in other places where you take women out of the equation. Women are part of society, and you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, as far as I'm concerned. But what the people say who believe in, you know, women not going out mm-hmm. of the house, staying in, not having jobs, and so on, is they say it's for women's protection and it's better for them to be at home, and it's been ordained this way, and so on and so forth. I don't happen to agree.
Is this less a religious than a kind of cultural pattern?
Yes, I think very often it is a cultural pattern. It's not necessarily, I should say, the cultural, or not invariably, the cultural pattern of the Prophet Muhammad. His wife, his first wife, Khadija, was a trader. She was mm-hmm. a businesswoman, mm-hmm. and she employed him. That's how they met.
Ah.
So that's a fantastic role model for women for a start. But very often I think that it is a cultural thing, certainly in Afghanistan. Islam came relatively late to Afghanistan, and there was already this strong tribal culture, and the Islam sort of been grafted on top of it. Places like Saudi Arabia, it's slightly different. There's been a kind of revolution there, and a religious revolution of the Wahhabi sect, which mm-hmm. is a very purist sect, which really believes that you should go to the letter of the law and you should find out what the law is, and you shouldn't really do things that you mm-hmm. are not actually laid down. Also has a similar position on women.
And it's hard for Westerners to understand, but the Wahhabists and the Taliban, in some contexts, are reformers. They're trying to reform the Islam.
Yes, I mean, I'll set Wahhabis aside for a moment and just talk about mm-hmm. the Taliban,
yeah.
but that is also an interesting point. I think what has happened to Afghanistan is at least in part the cause of caused by outside factors. So how the Taliban came around was Afghanistan became the center, first of all, as we've said, of a sort of superpower conflict, fighting it out by proxy in Afghanistan. Then the elastic band broke. The Soviet Union withdrew, and the West withdrew as well. And the people that the West had sponsored, the Mujahideen, with many weapons and mm-hmm. so on, created chaos in Afghanistan, anarchy. There was a situation where the country's prime minister, a man called Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who was a former darling of the United States, he'd been given something like 40% of US military aid, he started to shell his own capital, and 25,000 people were killed. I think the world does bear some sort of responsibility. Of course, the Taliban then looked like
sure.
reformers, because they said, we can bring law and order,
right.
but it came at a terrible price.
Indeed. We're talking about the past, present, and future of Afghanistan with journalist Syra Shah, author of the new memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with journalist Syra Shah about her new memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter. Did you watch her documentaries on Afghanistan about women living under the Taliban? Do you remember the soccer stadium executions and the blue burqas? Can you imagine a freer Afghanistan where women are educated and protected under law? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Saheed is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and I wanted to thank your guest for the wonderful work that she has done. Quick comment. I had the good fortune of living in Kabul, Afghanistan from 1970 to 1974, prior to all the troubles starting there. And I would have to say that it was a beautiful country. I feel privileged to have been able to be there during that time.
And that was before the Soviet invasion.
Exactly.
In fact, Afghanistan had a period there of sort of flowering, didn't it?
Afghanistan's always been a very poor country, but it was a very peaceful country, and the role of women, it was in terms of Muslim societies, it was quite open. There were women had the choice of wearing the burqa or not, and many contributed to all walks and aspects of life. But what I wanted to say is the issue that that we talk about, the conflict between moderate Islam and radical Islam.
Yes.
And I would go so far as to say that radical Islam is best understood as a political movement rather than as a religion, because one of the biggest misconceptions about radical Islam is that it is pious. It is not. It is a falsification of Islam. Islam is, as your guest was saying, is accepting of others, the people of the book, as she was saying, Christians and Jews. Christians and Jews lived and fared very well in Iran, in Afghanistan, before these radicals took over. And why has modern Islam been quiet?
Mm-hmm.
It's been quiet because of the brutality with which voices of moderate Islam have been snuffed. Many names like Salman Rushdie, like Tahmina Nassim, and other authors, even people in the West who dared to translate the works of Salman Rushdie, have been murdered by radical Islamists in the West, in Western Europe, and in America. Organizations like the Council for Islamic American Relations, which in its surface look like the ACLU for the Muslim world, are nothing but terrorizing organizations that terrorize any moderate voice of Islam. That people can
even in the United States, they somehow put pressure on people.
Absolutely. All you have to do is to be labeled. Many even American reporters when they get labeled, people like Emerson. They can get labeled as enemies of Islam by these supposedly moderate organizations, and then they need police protection and so on and so forth. But the moderate Islam is America's biggest ally in the war against terrorism, because long before Americans became victims of radical Islam, other Muslims and moderate Muslims were their victims. And what they have done in countries like Afghanistan and Iran is a lesson to all to all of us. If we pay attention to moderate Muslim support and allow them to have more expression, we will learn from their courage, because the courage which with people like Abdul Karim Suroush in Iran, who says in the midst of the radicalism in Iran, stands up to say that there is no one straight path, that there are many straight paths, that the Christians have their own straight path, the Jews have their own straight path. He preaches for choice in religion. In many of these radical countries now, countries where radical Islam has taken place, the religion is forced upon people.
Yeah. Let's get Saira Shah's response to this.
Yes, I agree. I think you put it very succinctly and well, and it's true. There certainly is a feeling of sort of unspoken threat, probably among most moderate Muslims, that people may be a bit shy and frightened to talk out. I agree. I hadn't realized it was so bad in the States. Actually, I've certainly seen it in other places. I didn't realize it was so bad over here.
Saeed? Have you any examples of things that have happened to Muslims over here who've been quieted by? You could go on and give us example after example.
In fact, one interesting example. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Kandahar.
Yes.
It's a great movie. It's brilliant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The American doctor in that movie. The man who plays the American doctor.
Yes.
Was actually wanted by the FBI. He assassinated a prominent Iranian dissident in Washington D.C. and fled to Iran.
Well, this is the first I'd heard that. That's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well, well.
internet and do a Google search on his name, and you will find the whole dossier that FBI has on the internet. Multiple Iranian dissidents have been terrorized and murdered in Western Europe, in France in particular. And I can rattle off a long list of names.
You're giving us a frightening picture. Thank you very much for your call. Sarah, how is it? He's talking about the intimidated silence, really, of the silent majority in Islam. But what could the West do to talk to these people? You know, we hired an advertising woman who sold soap to try to make commercials that would ingratiate Americans in America to Arabs. That didn't seem to work.
I didn't know that.
Yes, what could work? If there are these people out there who are our allies in this war, how do we find them and what do we say to them?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I certainly know, having traveled a tiny bit in America, that just because I have a funny name, I have a Muslim name, Shah, sometimes, you know, computers pick me out in airlines and I get extra searches and it feels almost as though you're a threatening alien when you come here with a Muslim name. And I'm sure that one of the problems is that, you know, you do have this vast body of moderate Muslims, and I absolutely believe that your caller was right, that they are your perfect ally against the war, against the radical Islamists, because, frankly, you know, we're the first people to line up against the wall and shoot.
Right.
But somehow all Muslims are lumped into the same category and are led to feel that they are somehow, you know, threatening and anti-Western, which is not the case.
Yes. Well, we have just time for a closing reading from you, really from the end of your book. You're leaving Afghanistan.
Yes, and this is right at the very end. The James mentioned is James Miller, my friend and colleague, who was tragically killed in May, and Usman is our guide. Early the next morning, we left Afghanistan. Usman came to see us off. Neither James nor I spoke on the brief, dusty journey to the northern border. We felt as choked and defeated as the broken road that lay ahead. At the ramshackle border post, the officer glanced at my passport, then looked at it again and said, "But that is an Afghan name. Are you from Afghanistan?" I told him that my father came from Paghman, and then, to stop him launching into the usual rapturous cascade of greetings, I added severely, "But I am from Britain. I am from the West." James, Usman, and I stood awkwardly together beside the river Oxus. James was watching the metal pontoon make its leisurely way towards us. Usman was gazing yearningly across the water at the bright lights of Tajikistan on the other side. I stepped onto the pontoon, guiltily glad to be leaving Afghanistan. A stretch of muddy brown water opened up between me and the shore. Then, as I watched the distance between me and my homeland growing ever wider, the voice of the border official came wafting confidently from the bank I had just left. "She may look like a Farangi, a foreigner, but her father is from Paghman and her mother is from Indonesia. As Khudema hast, she is one of us. She is an Afghan."
And so you feel an Afghan too, at least part of you, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, secretly, it's still the place I believe I come from. I'm practical enough. I've visited enough times to know that, I've had a very different background, a very different outlook. But, you know, if I owe allegiance to any one place, it's Afghanistan. I love the place. I love the people.
Well, Sarah Shah, thank you so much for your memoir and for your company tonight. We learned a lot and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Mikhail Gorbachev encourages the world to join the U.S. reconstruction effort in Iraq. This is On Point. After 2 days of talks with President Bush late last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin refused to commit troops or money to the reconstruction effort in Iraq. He also did not agree to offer support to a new UN resolution that the U.S. hopes will encourage other nations to aid the effort there. Today, a former Russian leader, Nobel Prize winner Mikhail Gorbachev, criticized the cold reception the United States has received from Russia and the international community. While chiding the United States for acting alone, Gorbachev said the great powers should come together. Here is an excerpt from Mikhail Gorbachev's speech delivered today at Brown University in Rhode Island.
The position taken by President Putin has not been supported by everyone in the Russian political establishment. Some of them think that since the Americans created the situation, they should sort it out themselves. I believe that this position is unacceptable. It could only result in the perpetuation of the division among great powers on the problem that is today of major importance, to say nothing of the fact that the Iraqi people would pay for this, the Iraqi people who are not to blame. So it is in the interest of the Iraqis and in the interest of stability in that region and in the world that the international community should assume a decisive role in rebuilding Iraq and should also provide guarantees for a political solution within Iraq that would respect the will of the Iraqi people, and to do that now, to do that quickly, within the next few months. The draft resolution now being discussed at the United Nations would, I hope, make it possible to reach an acceptable compromise. As a result of this, the problem would revert to the UN Security Council, and this would be the beginning of renewed interaction between the leading powers, between the major powers. This is what we all vitally need. A lot of work is ahead of us. It is always more difficult to rebuild than to break down. The pursuit of peace, as John Kennedy said, is not as dramatic as the path of war. But I am convinced that the use of force and preemptive strikes will not bring security. But if we act together against the real forces of evil, if we work together to address real problems of the global world, we will give the citizens of our countries a peaceful and secure future to which they are entitled and for which they are hoping.
Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev speaking earlier today at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoe, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.